Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 610. I'm going to be doing stand-up this week in San Francisco at Cobb's Comedy Club. Go to cobbscomedyclub.com. It is the December 11th through the 13th. And then starting mid-January, my full-on tour, Fun Comfortable. If you go to funcomfortabletour.com, there's a bunch of the dates there. Portland, Denver, Seattle, Chicago, St. Louis, Minneapolis, Madison, Wisconsin, Columbus, Ohio, Atlanta, Georgia. And then separately from that site, the Wilbur Theater in Boston, and then Best Buy Theater in New York. And then more stuff's going to be added, so go check it out. Get some tickets. Come out and say hi. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Loot Crate, which is a monthly subscription box service for incredible pop culture gear and items that are relevant to your interests. For less than $20 a month, you can get 6 to 8 items that are going to get you licensed gear, apparel, collectibles, unique one-of-a-kind stuff. You have until the 19th of each month at 9 p.m. Pacific to subscribe. Then you'll receive that month's crate. But then when the cutoff happens, that's it. It's over. They're gone. It's sort of like having a friend who knows that you love being surprised by a present every month. And what's cool about it is that you'll forget that you've subscribed, and then all of a sudden you'll have a crappy day. And you'll, oh, box of stuff for me. From me. So, or you can give the stuff away, you know, to friends. Like, make it little gifts. You like being social, so show up. Be the person who is defined by the fact that every time you show up, you bring a cool little thing. And then people will flock to you. Because people only like you when you give them stuff. Oh, wait, that's a bad message. But they do like it when you give them stuff. Make sure to head to lootcrate.com/nerdist. Enter the code NERDIST to save 10% on any new subscription. They also ship to Canada, Australia, the UK, with more info on their site, lootcrate.com. Well, Internet, I must break you. This podcast, I never knew if it was going to happen, but I met this gentleman at Comic-Con this year, and he was fantastic. Super cool. He is exactly as warm and charming and funny and introspective and articulate as you would hope he would be. And so now the collective gush that you're hearing is Tumblr right now. As I am posting this podcast, The Imitation Game, which he's starring in, is a phenomenal movie, and I got to see it before the podcast. It comes out Christmas Day, and you should absolutely see it. This is the Nerdist Podcast, number 610, with Mr. Benedict Cumberbatch, who I'm just going to say is my new friend. I don't know if he's on board that or not, but I'm just going to say that because it makes me feel better about myself. And now he's going to be your friend. See how that works? I would like to point out one thing, which is a lot of you are probably like, did you ask him about Doctor Strange? Did you ask him about Doctor Strange? Did you ask him about Doctor Strange? And the answer is no, because we recorded this several weeks back, and that was still a rumor at that point, and there wasn't really anything you could say about it. So I did not say, hey, tell me about Doctor Strange. So I'm just preparing you before you start commenting to me that I did not ask about Doctor Strange. I'm well aware of that. And it would have gone like this. Hey, tell me about Doctor Strange. I don't know what you're talking about. Oh, next question. So that is why it is not included on the podcast. I humbly apologize. But I'm sure that there will be no end to the flood of Doctor Strange Cumberbatch-related news now that it has officially been announced. Maybe some of that will be over at Nerdist.com.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Doing this all day?
Yes.
Are you guys lying? No. It's a podcast. You can say whatever you want.
We can cut whatever you want.
It could be a thunderous flurry of swears for 59 minutes. Oh, wow. And then you can...
I've done that in the past. I think it's a little early, though. I don't know, it's kind of tea time where I come from, but...
It is right now, yeah.
We don't swear until after supper.
No, you can't do that. You can do anything on the BBC after a certain amount of time.
I mean... Anything.
Really anything. So this will be yours. That's your clown head.
Okay.
Welcome. I briefly met you at
San Diego Comic Con, and I was dressed as Marty McFly, and you were nice enough to noogie me as Biff. But then you told me about this.
I went to a secret cinema. Have you heard about that?
You told me about that. That's what I wanted to find out about.
Yeah. What was I already planning to go?
I don't know.
Was this about that, or did you just find out later on the Tinder twet?
I don't. It was. You said. Was this what you said in the, that there was some convention in London?
Basically, what they. Oh, I must have told you about it. Yeah, there's a wonderful organization that does this thing of finding, first of all, this sort of site specific location to stage a world of the film that you're going to go and see. Mm-hmm. And they've done Shawshank Redemption. They've done. Have they done Aliens? I mean, they've done extraordinary
Which
films.
Part of the world of Shawshank are they in?
They make everyone
Not
escape.
Not the 100 yards of shit, are they?
The prison.
It's just
yeah,
that smell.
They have to escape.
You're all vomiting.
No. You have to go through that to get to the site. That's
and
called,
it's also
that's called,
it's like a 30-year festival where you have to slowly chip away.
Yeah. No, this is like... this was actually... It was in the middle of where they held the Olympics. It was... In a huge, well, the only weird thing about it was there was a sort of Westfield sign about floating above, you know, the kind of the high school prom, which was a bit weird. But it was brilliant. They had the high school, they had the high school prom, they had the masters and the mistresses, the, you know, the teachers. They had these kind of themed stalls selling, you know, clobber from the era, the hats and clothes and shoes. And it was so cool. And just a fun sort of atmosphere for everybody before the film actually gets going. And then when the real treat, though, is when the film gets going, you have this kind of 20D experience where, you know, you've got the film up there and you've got Marty McFly running, you know, being chased by Biff, skateboarding around you, around, you know, the town square. You've got the clock tower above the actual... the image below, and then, you know, in the middle of this door just opens, and the car, they had a replica car. It was amazing.
That's a very immersive nerdy film.
It was great.
The closest thing I think we have here is, but it's not really, there's no props or anything, it's just the Hollywood Forever Cemetery. Have you been?
Yeah, no, I've heard about that. That sounds very cool.
It is, but they just
sort of dress up as your favorite character in something and go and see something, is that right?
Or no, well, you. It's really just, they project a movie on the side of the mausoleum, and then people, hipsters show up with picnic baskets, and that's basically it.
Essentially, yes. But Secret Cinema is coming to Los Angeles.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
What is this?
They're doing Back to the Future next year in LA.
Oh, are they?
Yeah.
Ooh,
well, yeah,
because
next year's 2015.
Yeah.
That's Back to the Future 2.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right. God, you're good.
Mm-hmm. They should just do it on the Universal lot because the clock tower is still sitting there.
I know, but see, we went to the Universal Horror Mazes for Halloween.
Yeah.
And we had this private guide, and Matt goes, are we near the clock tower? And the guy was like, sure. So we broke out of the mazes, and the guy took us to the town square, and he's like, here's where the Texaco station was, and, you know, this is where this is the clock tower.
You're kidding me. That's
it was
cool.
The best night of
it's
my
brilliant,
life.
It's brilliant, isn't it?
It was really amazing.
I thought he got misty. He was like,
can we just talk for a second? What is it? Back to the Future 3? Do you know this viral clip on the internet with the strange kid with the pointing thing?
Yeah, pointing at his... That was Vern, because his kids were named Jules and Vern.
Jules and Vern.
Right.
Yeah.
So, Vern, did we ever get to the bottom of that? Has the actor who did that ever been asked?
I don't think he has.
It's very peculiar. Do you know what the clip I'm talking about?
He had an itchy dick.
Oh, did he scratch his...
I mean, I don't know. I don't know.
let's get to the bottom of this, internet.
Yeah, it's pretty creepy.
Time travel is very tough on
the genitals. It could just be, look, I need to go to the bathroom now. I'm going to hold it for another take.
But it could be something
a little bit more salacious than
that. It's less scratchy and more like, huh?
Is that where they're standing on the train?
Out this.
Is that where they're just standing on the train at the end?
Yes, at the very end.
Any scratches?
And there's like a creepy close-up of it they do online when you watch the
clip.
And
his hand just sort of goes like this for radio audiences, this podcast. This is perfect. Goes like this. It's weird.
It's like he's circling the button. Are you trying to find the clip, Katie? No.
Oh, there's
geez.
15 seconds. We'll skip it.
So did they have to commercialize that? That seems like a weird thing.
I mean, welcome to the
Olive Garden.
Do you have Olive Garden out there?
No, we don't. Oh. Is that a sort of family Italian restaurant?
Yeah, it's a terrible Italian restaurant.
Here we go. Look.
And Vern!
He says, no, it's not these two. It's third child.
Right,
oh, it is.
Yeah. That's Vern.
Hang on a minute. It's not third child. I think it looks very different. There it goes. There it is.
Yeah.
Beckoning.
There it is. What just happened? Why did he do that?
I mean, why the beckoning gesture and then the point is what I really.
Why did he do that?
Like, come
he was
here.
Almost to the camera
it's
guy.
The camera
like,
guy.
Closer.
This is what you want to be focused on.
This is the shot.
Yo.
This is the shot.
Money shot.
He knew. Oh, that's creepy. So creepy.
But come I think it might mean he needs the
bathroom. Yeah, yeah, it might.
I'm hoping. I'm really hoping.
Zemeckis, need to go. Stop down.
I wonder if they notice that in the edit. Like after they go, oh, great day of shooting. They get in the edit, like, what the fuck is this?
Like Ben Affleck last night, the Hollywood Film Awards. You know, he was talking about the fact that Fincher filmed a bit of him in the nude at the end of Gongo, which is just sort of completely unnecessary and to the story, to everybody's enjoyment of the film. And apparently, it is just this. It's this again. You know, another kind of clip sensation on the internet.
Just a strange. By the way, congratulations for last night.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You won an award.
I did win an award.
That's a little award.
How does it feel? Award. it was very nice, although I had just got off the plane, and it, by the time I was on the stage, which I think was very near the end of the evening, I think it was just Ben after me, I'd heard everybody speaking so eloquently about their roles, about their experiences, about their parents and ping pong and all sorts of fun things, and also people speaking about my film, about, you know, Mawson had received an award, as had Kira. I was left sort of dry, so I thought, well, and you know, Robert Duvall was being given the music, you know, and Robert Duvall, I mean,
oh, they were trying to play him off,
yes. And so I thought, Christ, there's no room here for the sort of 5-page monologue I'd written, so I kind of screwed that up into a little ball and got on stage, and it just all went by in a blur. It was terrifying, but I think it turned out right. I don't know, I haven't seen it yet.
So you said something like, I don't believe in quantifying performance, and you threw the award on the ground,
yeah.
And then
yeah. Down with competition. Boom. There wasn't any competition with that. That was the weird thing. And also, I was so confused when I arrived, because I thought I wasn't supposed to know that I'd won. So I was saying, I sort of saw Eddie, and I was like, hello, Eddie. How are you today? Isn't it great that we're here? And then Felicity came up and said, congratulations. I went, on what? And she went, your engagement?
Oh, yes. Oh, right. I know. It's a good thing you didn't go.
She gave me a really warped look, but I actually have to apologize to Felicity Jones on this podcast. I think she thought, my God, the career is just all about the career for him. It's a personal life or any kind of existence outside of these, but these extraordinarily just, heightened events.
You could have just blurted it out. I'm sorry, I didn't know I was supposed to win.
I kind of wanted to, but again, I still felt kind of hamstrung by the whole sort of thing of the event, and it was that, are we supposed to know, are we, you know, because everyone asked me on the red carpet, they said, congratulations on being honored tonight, and I thought, well, it's an honor to be here, you're quite right, it's an honor enough to be here, which it, I mean, that actually, you know, all kind of joking aside, it really was, it was an amazing room of people, and the films and the talent and across the board is just extraordinary this year, so to be clumped together no matter what is great. But yeah, I didn't really realize that the game was up, and I was actually in the program as having. but even seriously, CBS, I asked him, and I was like, "So, how, did the people? I don't think they know. No, I don't think they know." And then everyone seemed to know.
It's in the program.
Him. Yeah, it's in the
program. Seriously, if there's one person you could take out of the pool, which actor would it be? No, I'm kidding.
We're all winners. Literally,
some less than others because I have this award and you don't. But in a way, we're all still alive.
I think most of the sort of, yeah, if we, yeah, we all, there were a lot of people winning last night, which is great.
Do you find that the more known you become, that the world is a giant improv game where you have to yes and everything because people are telling you things? And you're like, and you may not know exactly what they're talking about.
And I think that's the best way to live anyway, really, because then you could be a little bit more true to yourself. But my God, you get hit hard by people who want to take you down, because it's like, yeah, you make mistakes. I recently sort of reviewed an article that, they were gracious enough to bring up and fact check it. We just want to check a couple of things. Did Benedict really play Oppenheimer? And I was like, no, Benedict didn't play Oppenheimer. He played Heisenberg in a play by Michael Frayn called Copenhagen. And anyway, when you're on it, and it is continual at the moment. And I'm also from this going back to work, play Richard III for the BBC.
Oh my God.
In the continuation of the Hollow Crown series. So I literally did, I was here for about 4 days. Last trip, and then I went back to the UK for 3 days, 2 days filming and 1.5 days travel, and then arrived last night, literally have yo-yoed across the Atlantic, and you know, one from this coast to England.
Okay, so you're going to Richard III. Is there any part of it that's like, Maybe I should just do a fart comedy with Adam Sandler.
Like, I mean, absolutely. I was on the plane. I was on the plane back to from. No, I'm really good at farts, and I like Adam. And comedy is my middle name. But
Benedict Comedy Cumberbatch.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's been said before. That's probably not the first
time. Your parents really sidled you with that middle name.
Yeah, it's an odd thing. I think they were just trying to hint to the public at large that, you know, should this career go well, then, you know.
And if you weren't funny, then they could be like, well, it's for irony.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The payoff is in the fact that it's the opposite. He's not funny at all. I had, I was on the plane back from here. The journeys, which one was it? Which way was I going? It was from here to London. And the entire cabin was filled with horrible bosses too.
Oh.
It was just a joy. And literally, Bateman was sort of ribbing me the middle, which one said, well, here you are in a la-di-da suit. Is this because it's your airline? Because I'd literally just stepped off some red carpet for the presentation of the film here. And I went, oh, and look at you with your long, dark hair. Trying to be Sherlock, are you? There's only one on this plane. Oh, wait, let me check. Maybe John Lee Miller or Downey Jr. is on here. It was really good fun. And JC Sudeikis as well, who I've met a few times. Just an adorable, brilliant bunch of people. I mean, really good fun to hang out with. However, I said my hellos. We had a lovely chat, and then I just stuck my earplugs in and slept for 5 hours.
I think everyone understands. I think that's it. Yeah, by the way, you just mentioned Johnny Lee Miller, of course, American Sherlock. But
yeah.
I saw your Frankenstein, but I saw it in the theater here.
Cool.
And you were playing the monster, and he was playing Frankenstein. Did you guys see them?
I didn't. I saw that it happened. I did not go.
Did you flip-flop every night?
Every night, yeah. So, every day. So every night, one of us would be doing the other role.
Jesus.
Yeah. And there was one day when you saw that, the filming of that, where we did them both in one day. So we did a matinee first, which I think was Johnny's creature, and then I was the creature in the evening, and that was just in one day. We were going to do that on matinee days, but we just didn't know whether the turnaround for makeup and de-rigging as well as getting into makeup was going to work, because it took me about 2.5 hours, I think, to get into it, because I had to have a skull cap because I was growing my hair back for Sherlock. Mm-hmm. Johnny shaved it all off, which I would have loved to have done. But that also made it harder because then he had to wear a wig when he was playing the doctor.
Oh, right,
so
right,
there
right.
was the, you know, give and take on both kind of sacrifices, really. But I took a little bit longer. I think I did because of that. He has, well, I don't know, any tattoos. He has tattoos to cover up, so that took a bit of time. And then the D-rig always, for both of us, took about an hour and a half.
Wow.
So it was nice to call myself an actor in those days, because it was proper work. I mean, it was a proper working day, you know, hard, long hours, but, you know...
with virtually no set, too. I mean, it was really just a...
Yeah, no, there was a huge amount of set. Did you not think there was much set?
I just mean there wasn't... I mean, it was a very... the space was very sparse. I mean, like, it wasn't...
I guess so. At times it was. I mean, obviously, you know, the scenes set in the Alps were, by their nature, sparse. But the stuff in the house, there was a fantastic... oh, God, what is it called? In the Olivier, this mechanism that basically... It's like a drum, a revolving drum that goes up and down, and you can... It's fantastic, the mathematical possibilities. You can shuffle in about four different sets, even though it's got two levels. You can change a set and then bring one up whilst another one goes down. It's incredible. So we use that. We use that to great effect. And also sort of Christo-style wrapped the auditorium, so you felt included. There was this shaft. I mean, I wish people who've seen it in the cinema could have got to see it on stage, because it was physically really extraordinary to be in that room. There was a bell that was founded 8 centuries ago or something ridiculous. I mean, one of the oldest bells in London that was rung at the beginning of the show. The sound alone that Underworld produced, this kind of throb of life that was coming into being at the beginning of the show when the creature's born, the lighting effects, which were so hot that if you were underneath them, there was something like, I can't remember how many thousands of light bulbs, old filament light bulbs, a testament to electricity being the Promethean fire that man had invented, that spawned these incredible mythical stories of Promethean creation, like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. But it shot a bolt on a mirrored background that really, it was like being under an intense sun lamp wherever you were sat in a sort of 1,000-seater auditorium. I mean, it was a very visceral show to be a part of. So if you had any more on stage, you'd kind of be, you'd be kind of freaking out by the interval and not coming back. It was quite an all-out assault. You know, Danny knows how to put on a show, and a very committed cast and crew threw it at the audience every night. So it was an amazing experience. Painful.
Was there any
very painful?
Was there any part where in the middle you're like, oh fuck, that's your line? Like, did you?
More me than Johnny. Johnny suffered my, you know, my ridiculous brain farts a lot more than I ever had to have his. I mean, he's such an extraordinary performer. He's so acute in detail and stamina, and just he's brilliant and a great sparring partner and somebody who's so supportive all the way through it. And I don't think many actors would have put up with me doing that, but you know, being able to do that shifting. And he was wonderful. We became very, very good friends because of it. And yeah, I definitely fucked up more than he did. Oops.
You can say whatever you want.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Fuck. Yeah. So I just try it out.
That's going to be everyone's ringtone. That's like
a little packet of fuck.
Put that out. Put that in the M4. Or M4
actually, or... whilst we're swearing, I think my favorite swear of recent years is Kenneth Branagh playing Olivier in My Week with Marilyn. When he's just being really nice with her, but his patience is worn out. She's late again. And he goes, Marilyn, darling, sweetheart, you're wonderful. You're beautiful. You're heaven sent. Your talent is gorgeous. But for the love of fuck, will you turn up on time? That's so good. For the love of fuck. Makes me laugh every time. But yeah, I had a great experience doing that. It was, yeah, there were moments, definitely, I think earlier on where there was a head bleed, a couple of really scary moments in previews where I just went, oh no, that's what I say when I'm you. And Johnny sort of widened his eyes. I was like, okay, awkward.
And your nose starts bleeding.
Well, it wasn't that bad, but yeah, it's in my brain.
Oh God. Fuck.
If you're the creature, when in doubt, just go into convulsions.
I mean, but yeah, physically, you know, I hurt myself. I hurt Johnny as well. I mean, he really did put up a lot with me. He really was very patient. There's this moment where I spin the disc around to discover the female Frankenstein, the bride of Frankenstein that he's creating, that he's going to give to the creature, and then gets terrified of the idea of them spawning this whole sort mm-hmm. of species of how he sees them as now being monsters. It was early doors. I was teching the creature for the first time, so we did it that way around, and then Johnny then teched his creature. But it was one of the first moments on stage as Frankenstein for him, the doctor, and I span the thing round, and he hadn't cleared it at the back, and I just had this like that. And he carried on the scene. It's like blood pouring from his face, and there's a new bit of footage that they wanted me to okay, just to release, because I think it's coming out quite often now and on Halloween and stuff here and around the world, which is very cool. But I looked at the interview. We look wrecked. We look so tired. I mean, he looks pretty coherent. And also he has a young child, but Buster was very young then. Pretty superhuman marathon man he is. But anyway, you know, so he, but the thing he was wearing on his head, I was like, what's that little scratch on? And I went, oh no. For all time, that will be now there on video.
And then he does this scratch, and then points at his dick.
No!
He didn't do that?
There's no junk indication. Okay. No.
Do you realize
that? We didn't have time to muck around by pointing at our dicks.
But I feel like...
Our dicks were out. There was no need to point.
Oh, okay, yeah.
They were there. Well, probably there was. It was cold. Yeah. Air conditioning in 1,100 people can make you more of a grower, not a shower.
Yes. So like a turtle receding into its shell.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
I understand.
Exactly.
By the way, I feel like
a sea anemone caught on a sunny day on the edge of a rock, vanishing to
like
whence
like
never knew it came.
Blending with its surroundings like as it pulls back into itself.
Like
like a tiny bird in an eggshell. But I feel
like time-lapse photography of the Eiffel Tower being built
in reverse.
Yes, shrinking to the ground.
This is like the Statue of Liberty
returning
on the
to the smelting foundry from whence
from
the
France.
Steel came. Yeah.
Like the planets, the swirling eddies
this
of the
could
universe.
Run and run.
Well, listen, I could tell a dick joke for a day and a half. But I feel like this is something that accomplished actors like yourself need to start inserting and just...
What,
just
dick jokes?
No, this.
Yeah.
Insert more dick jokes.
Just,
that could be taken
just,
any,
just,
every,
the, just,
just the indication.
Just in the background
the
somewhere. Just in the background somewhere.
Yeah.
That would be legendary.
All right.
We're not sure if Imitation Game was the appropriate film for that, but you do other stuff that you could...
Hamlet next June.
Hamlet,
on the stage.
You do it on Hamlet.
Barbican, yeah, that's coming up.
I mean, Sherlock, you're shooting more of those. You could throw one.
He's got a long coat.
Slip that by Moffat, no problem.
Yeah, exactly. The internet had its way, I'd probably do it to Dr. Watts. And so the Sasha fiction was born.
That's where the Sasha fiction... Yeah, there you go. Just, all right, guys, you wanted this. Well, I mean, talking about breaking the internet, watching you imitate Tom Hiddleston... I think Tumblr got pregnant. Like, the only thing that could have made that, if you had done it on a hoverboard with kittens on it, then I think the internet would have just folded in on itself and Kardashian would have been like, why didn't I think of that?
But the thing is...
That's what you would have done, Chris.
Yeah, why I should have thought of that.
No comment. I would love... Yeah, I only saw it yesterday. So, again, another sort of discombobulating thing to happen to you on a red carpet when it's, you know, 3 in the morning where you come from is to... Everyone say, how does it feel to break the internet again? And I went, a bit embarrassing. What have I done now? You know, I had no idea. I had no idea what it was. It was, oh my God, and your impersonations. And I was, I genuinely didn't know what they were talking about. And they went, oh yeah, there was that MTV interview I did where he played on the idea of the imitation game and made it into a game for how many. Anyway, I hadn't seen it. And I watched it last night. I was like, all I could think of was like, oh, fuck, man. Christopher Walken, where was that? that came out disgracefully wrong. I don't know why. But, you know,
Do Walken. No, I'm
kidding. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It's one of those things where...
It was bizarre. It was, but I did, and I did, honestly, genuinely, half the ones he was asking me, I was thinking, Alan Rickman, yeah, I've done him before, the poor man. I've even stolen a part from him in The Simpsons, poor man. But I haven't... Yeah, there were a lot of them that were. I was clueless to know whether they would come out right.
They all came out great, and I think it was one of those things where, because I was going, wait, did they seed this guy with these imitate? But he just threw them at you on the spot.
Oh yeah, no, there's no preparation. No, he just went for it. Yeah, and I dived in. Have you willingly?
Now you have to host SNL.
It's been talked of a while ago, actually, and I'd love to do that. Absolutely love to do that.
That would be amazing.
It is a thing of scheduling, though, which is it's just a bit bonkers for me at the moment. So, but yeah, I mean, fans keep on saying romantic comedy with the emphasis on romantic and comedy. You know, right. They want to see me being sort of normal, attractive in a normal way, and also being funny. And so it's sort of a shock that I have any kind of sense of humor, I think, because I sort of played quite intense, sort of difficult but unique characters. And at the same time, yeah, I absolutely love my comedy. And I think what they do on SNL is fly by the pants, seat of your pants, terrifying but brilliant, brilliant work. And, you know, some of my greatest comedians have come out of there of recent times.
Do you think
all times? I mean,
do you think comedy? Do you,
in America,
you might not be able to answer this.
Go,
but
if you could do comedy, you can do anything.
Okay, so comedy harder than drama?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay,
I think so. Definitely. Well, I mean, I grew up watching a mother doing farce and dad as well. He was in a Michael Frayn play called Noises Off, which is this brilliant version of the farce. It's a farce about a farce. Mm-hmm. A farcical farce. And as with all Michael Frayn's work, it's extraordinary.
Now, if it were in Farsi.
It wasn't Farsi. Yeah, Farsi. Ah. Nicole Farsi. No, that doesn't work. And also mum being in lots of Ray Cooney farces in the sort of late 90s, early 90s, late 90s. So, I kind of grew up watching. And also with Michael Williams, Judi Dench's sadly deceased husband. And Donald Sinden, you know, two great classical actors, classical theatre actors, just busting guts, doing this extraordinary work. It's the same with Mark Rylance and what he does. You know, he's such a kind of chameleon and an alchemist in every guise he ever dons. But he's a remarkable comedian as well as being a great tragedian. Tragedian? Is that a word? It is.
We'll call it a word.
Tragedian.
Oh, might God. Be a British
it's
another, word.
It's a Penguins moment.
By definition, if it's a British word, it's a word.
It's a word. I just mean...
I mean, we're all speaking English.
No, I understand.
Invented the dictionary. Hello.
To be fair, we borrowed a little from the Dutch, too.
Yes. Yes, so did we, I think. And the Germans. Anyway, let's not get into that. But the point is...
No, but guys, is it a Germanic language? What is it?
And now for grammar lessons. No, I think it's one of the hardest, if not the hardest form. I do think that. I cannot wait to see Steve Carell's turn in Foxcatcher for that very reason. I think it's always... you know, people are sort of surprised in a way. I know I'm not going to be. I know I'm just going to sit there going, yep, I knew that was in him. Because, you know, if you can do the other stuff, it's... And the same goes with sometimes with theatre as well. If you do theatre, it's easier, I think, to do film and television. It doesn't necessarily translate, but yeah, I think comedy is a very interesting discussion to have, though. I think if you can really crack that, you can do the serious stuff as well.
Is there a, do you have any plans to do anything?
Anything comedic?
Yeah.
Sherlock. So I'm just laughing because yes, I've got, you know, Hamlet, Lost City of Z. Not a lot of laughs in either of those. No, there are. Actually, the best Hamlets I've seen have been very funny. You should, you know, part of his charm is how fast and witty he is, you know. It's not just about sort of soul bearing and oversharing. It's and that intimacy that particular part really engenders in an audience, and what makes going on a journey with him overnight really, really unique and special. But it's the humor, and I think Sherlock. There's a lot of funnies in Sherlock.
Sherlock, yes,
it is funny.
Absolutely.
And I think the Christmas special, he is, but actually he reins it in. You know, he's a lot funnier than, you know, he's true to his character. You know, I mean, he's brilliantly funny in it, but there's a whole lot more funny. And I think he's very keen to play John as John Watson, not as Martin Freeman being funny, which right. We all know he can do effortlessly. Also, he makes it appear. And that's what makes him a great actor. Again, another person who earned his comedy chops. But also his comedy chops, as far as coming to the public for me, I remember seeing, well, I don't remember seeing him, but he was in stage productions that I went to see at the National. He was in Mother Courage and Volpone in that ensemble of actors. And, you know, the break I remember, like I think a lot of people, is The Office, but there's the amount of truth in that. I mean, that's what I mean by breaking in comedy. If you can bring truth to something and make it painfully funny because it's real, then you can go far with that talent, and Martin's proved that time after time. But I don't know. I'd love to do. I would. Yeah, there have been talks of things, but nothing I can share on a podcast.
Okay, sure.
Like
yeah,
that.
No worries.
But
no
it
worries.
Is it's scheduling, and it keeps me awake or wakes me up in the morning. Sometimes I go, I love where my career is going, but at the same time, I kind of do want to do another Guy Next Door and someone like Patrick Watts or someone like. You know, little Charles in August Osage County. Patrick Watts is a character I played in a film called Starter for 10, a British comedy, with James McAvoy, Rebecca Hall, James Corden. I mean, an amazing cast.
James Corden.
Yeah, you know, he's
funny.
Coming
to the States.
Yeah, he is, isn't he?
He's taking over Craig Ferguson's show.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. Wow.
He's going to do a talk show.
Wow. Am I going to do a talk show?
No.
He is. Oh, right. Yes. Sorry.
He's hosting a talk show.
No,
do you want to host a talk show?
No, no, no.
You
I don't. I thought he said, yeah.
Oh, I'll just guys, give you one.
I'll just
give
it. Yeah. This is amazing news. This is amazing.
John and I on CBS for 5 minutes chat. I'll just impersonate all my guests and end the show. Done.
It's just very poor.
People would watch the shit out of that. What are you talking about?
It's like when they used to have twins show up on old sitcoms where it was just a clear line down the middle of the screen.
Yeah, and they're mirrored.
If I explored the form of talk shows, it would have to be Between the Ferns style.
Yes.
You know, that's Zach was he was sort of sitting in the hotel lobby as I left this morning.
I just did a show with him last night.
Did you
at Largo? Yeah,
that's why he was looking wrecked behind a pair of
sunglasses. That's what it was.
He's extraordinary, and he's so good in Birdman. I didn't recognize him. That guy looks a bit like Zach Galifianakis. It looks a bit like him.
Yeah,
halfway through, I'm like, that fucking is
that's
Zach Galifianakis. It was
Birdman. Wasn't you like Birdman?
I loved it.
So good.
I loved it. I mean, just you know, on a sort of I don't know, Hall of Mirrors kind of industry and joke level. What a brilliant examination of all sort of. Highs and lows, the ego, the id, the all the kind of battles of integrity versus career versus love versus all the kind of venal short term as versus long term appetites that we all suffer from. And I just, it was brilliant, so richly enjoyable on that form. And then, wow, can he make a film? I mean, just what the camera does and those performances, which are just like, you're just finding people with that camera, just finding these
the entire
extraordinary
movie.
Situations. I mean, hats off. And I just think, you know, Michael is extraordinary in it, and he deservedly getting a lot of heat for it. But I mean, Ed Norton?
Yeah.
Fucking hell. I mean, that was such a confident performance. So easy. And to veer from this super cool guy, you think this literally there's nothing that can go wrong to be the guy drinking on stage and smashing the glass, berating the audience for being involved with their cell phones. And, the whole thing, I lapped it up. But everyone, the girls were so incredible in it, so incredible. Emma Stone just being extraordinary again. Andrea Riseborough never fails to amaze me, and Naomi Watts, I mean, it's just incredible in it.
It was a fun movie.
It's a great film. I cannot wait to see it again. You know,
I moderated the panel for it at New York Comic Con, but I think everyone thought,
oh yeah,
I kept saying to people like, okay, it's not a superhero movie,
but they did a Comic Con thing.
They did a Comic Con
that was daring.
That's weird.
That's kind of daring.
Appreciate that.
But you, cool. But you have a Hulk and you have a Batman on stage.
Yeah.
So
you do.
It's within the sphere of interest, like. And so they showed a couple of scenes, like the one scene where, you know, Birdman is like saves the city. But that's the only comic book kind of and after I was like, okay,
there's all the telekinesis, isn't there?
But not like you don't really. But Birdman's not like the character of Birdman isn't. It's only present in his head for almost the entire movie. Yeah. So,
but then I don't know. I think even superhero films these days are getting very smart at inverting the stereotype and surprising their audience, hopefully, and trying to battle against what is expected. So to have a film that's actually about a man struggling on a schizophrenic level with his alter ego. I think it would appeal to the smarts of a comic book.
It would,
crowd,
as long as they know. I just think sometimes
as long as it's not a false sell,
right?
Pitch,
so, sometimes,
I agree,
I think an audience. I think you can lead an audience anywhere, but they just need to know. They just need a little bit of a breadcrumb trail, so that they don't go in.
Yeah,
it's sort of like if you think you're about to take a sip of a Coke and it's water, and you're like, "What the fuck?" You know, it's like because your brain has set up this expectation. Yeah. So I think as long as people understand that, then they'll be totally open to how great it was.
You're right. But I mean, just on every level, an incredible achievement, I think, a really special film. It's another kind of game changer, I think, this year. I really do.
So just to jump back, to jump around a little bit, a few years ago, the first time I met Stephen Moffat, I was already way, way, way in the Sherlock camp.
Thank you.
So I made this comment, which I thought was really brilliant, where I was like, well, I mean, the Doctor is really just Space Sherlock, isn't he? And he was like, that's absolutely not true. The Doctor cares for everyone. Sherlock's a sociopath.
Oh, yeah. That's kind of true. And one uses a sonic screwdriver and time travel, and the other uses his brain. And is it 900 years old?
Is it
reincarnated?
In fairness, Chris meant Dr. House
MD. Crimes quite as much.
No, but it does solve universal crimes.
He talks fast and is clever. That's literally the only bracket they share. You know, they've got different dress senses, different tastes in the sex of their partners. Different, you know, it's that you could not. Yeah, it's apart from, and also Stephen writes both of them. That's kind of the only other thing that should ever, you know, be in that little crossover of the Venn diagram of Who and Sherlock. Also, you know, I mean, I get it all the time. Hey, man, love you as Doctor Who. And I'm like, good, great. That's fantastic. I'm glad. I'm glad you do, because I too enjoy myself as Doctor Who. But I thought I was the only one.
I'm usually in the bath when I'm Doctor Who.
Exactly.
I'm so glad the things I haven't done are being finally recognized by the public.
Exactly. Get it to the TARDIS. It's a different game. It's a very different game, and I think what's happening now with him, the human drama of it, is very different. He's on the side of the angels. He may not be one, as he says, but I think, you know, Watson's influence on him has helped to bring him to a point of humanizing him. He is still a sociopath. You can't do what I did at the end of the last series. Spoiler alert, not going to say, in case somebody out there who's listening to this hasn't seen it yet.
You get into the TARDIS, and then you and the doctor go around.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I blew it.
We adopt a dog called K9, and it's all happy days in Baker
Where
Street.
Where are we going, Sherlock?
For another walk in Regent's Park. Come on, Spotty. Different worlds, different worlds.
Yeah.
Also, we do three every 2 years, and they do something like, you know, a gazillion every week.
Oh, they're basically just they're just in Cardiff.
They are
for the year.
They kind of are,
and that's pretty much it. It sounds like, I'm sure it's really an honor to be like, oh, I'm the Doctor now. But then I think when they're in it, it's like, what's happening? Like,
I mean, I know all three of the recent ones. I know Chris even a little bit, but David is a friend, and Matt as well, a very good friend. And And Peter, I mean, I worked with Peter even before the thick of it kind of blew him up again. I mean, he's just always been an extraordinary actor, and I'm thrilled for him. I'm thrilled for him because he's such a fan of it as well. You can see that in his relish of playing him. And I watched a little clip of some footage of him entering the weird sphere of fandom for the first time, just and kind of being treated like a god. Literally, people went, "Doctor Who, Doctor Who," like this kind of Nazi rally, you know, it was kind of terrifying. But he was just taking it all in his stride, you know, like very, you know, he was very calm about the whole thing. You know, I was like, "Well, good. He's got his thing. He's got his rhythm there." He's yeah. But so, I mean, I'm a fan of it, but. New, they're different shows.
Now, yes, clear, very different shows. And when I first saw Sherlock, someone had basically slid me the DVDs because we hadn't got, it had aired in the in England, but we hadn't gotten it just yet.
Right.
And
just doing that so I don't waffle on. I'm just, sorry, that was so rude of me. I wasn't doing this. Game. Yeah, no. Right. You carry on.
Oh,
No. I just I was making sure that we had time left, so I don't waffle.
No, of course, don't worry. Essentially that show. At least here, I don't know what it was like. Would that be funny if you just walked out? Oh, wow. Like they had a Birdman. Oh, spoiler. Can you be emotionally prepared for what happens when all of a sudden you essentially become a household name and everyone is clamoring? Does that fame part
question.
Get in the way of, you know, just you as a performer?
Yeah. It does. It does. But you know, you can't complain about it. It's a product of your work being good. So that's the kind of weird irony of it. The more good work you do, the more you have to do the fame game, whether it's promoting that work or whether it's dealing with having a profile that's just sort of exponentially getting more public. And there are things you have to negotiate with that. I've been kind of lucky, though. I really have. I've got a very excitable but very intelligent and self-regulating fan base. I've got very sane people who've known me since year dot, let alone later in life, but well before things blew up for me, that can kind of keep me grounded. And I try as hard as I can to surround myself with them rather than the yes men. And beyond that, I still find space and time to do things that mattered to me before all of this occurred. So by and large, I'm not building walls higher or, you know, flying in private jets to islands. I'm kind of keeping it reasonably real as well. I mean, you know, God, I live a very heightened existence now, and I'm very grateful for that. It's not a reality that a lot of people share. I know how rarefied the air is, but at the same time, I try to make sure that I do things that I did do before. I do go on the tube still. I do use public transport in England. Never the bus, though. I hated buses. Being famous is a great excuse never to get on a bus again.
But I feel like in England,
why be trapped in a car with one person and your own radio station? Well, you could be trapped with 50. It's never been a favorite mode of transport. The underground is fantastic. I don't get claustrophobic in that sense, and it's quick. It's so quick. It's the quickest way of getting around any city, I think. I love my motorbike. I love riding around on that with a big old helmet of anonymity surrounding my Nugen. What else? Emotionally, that was your question, which is really good. Because I have no fucking idea. I mean, I don't. I mean, I probably should lie down on it. I did at the beginning of this year or the end of last year. I lay down on a couch and went, so have a look inside me, see what you see, and tell me what I need to watch out for. And I got a clean bill of mental health, which is great. I think it's important to do that as an actor anyway. I think it's very important to do that if you have the ability to do that and the means to do that, to stay sane and check in with yourself, you know.
Oh, yeah, because if you're popping around a bunch of different... I mean...
Well, yeah, that thing of transforming.
You're
different
poking different emotional centers in
but
your
also
brain.
This. I mean, you know, the variations of yourself all the time. It's like, well, where's your center in all of this, you know? I mean, I'm not saying this is acted, you know, I'm relaxed, we're chatting, I'm swearing, you know, things are pretty normal. This is, you know, Kaza Cumberbatch style, but you know, it's still, we're in a hotel room in LA and it's ages past my bedtime, tea time.
Yeah.
Bedtime, Jesus, that makes me really, really sound like an infant.
The sun's up, get into bed.
But you know what I mean? It's not naturally how I would be having this conversation if it wasn't for promoting a film. So, yeah, you know, you have to, there are just things you have to watch out for, I guess.
But, you know, not everyone's comfortable just sitting and, I mean, like, I think a lot of performers, probably gravitate toward
bypass the glass.
Yeah, right for the bottle.
But do you want some before I
start? Oh, maybe I'll have a little bit. Yeah, thank you very much.
It.
That's right. Don't bring those British germs over here, son.
God damn it. Keep them on
all right,
the plane.
Thank you very much.
Anybody else?
I'm good. Thank you. Okay.
But some people aren't.
Straight from the bottle, people.
Cumberbatch is in a robe.
What makes it the least rock and roll is that it's flat.
There's not even any fizz in it.
Not even
no
sparkle.
Aww.
Tequila's flat, my friends. As is vodka.
Do you think some performers, though, are not comfortable? If you try to talk to them as themselves, they don't really even know who that is, and they need to be portraying other entities.
Yeah, and I kind of admire that because there's a sort of integrity to that, which, you know, it keeps your energy close to your work. And that's the biggest fear I have, you know, as well as my own sanity, is just what it will do to corrupt stuff that I had as part of my, you know, my arsenal to perform with.
Second biggest fear, spiders?
Yeah, second biggest fear is definitely... No, it's not. What, do I have any phobias? Being late, which I often am, it just ties myself in knots.
You hate being late.
I hate being late. I hate what it does to myself.
Out of the way, Bigfoot, I'm late.
What's that, sorry?
He's afraid of Bigfoot.
You're
not afraid of anything.
Well, I'm very timely.
These goddamn spiders, I'm late.
Yeah. These spiders are making me late again. I can't.
I hate spiders as much as they make me late.
Bigfoot just
run
past me. Yeah.
Bigfoot's going to be on time, and I'm not.
I'm afraid that the spiders are going to make me late. That's what I'm afraid of spiders.
Yeah, that's the biggest fear I have. No, but one of you know, it's a genuine concern rather than fear, I think is a better way of putting it. God, dehydrated. Is that, you know, it can detract from the thing at hand. You know, I was very conscious when I went back to England to just sort of take my kind of acting temperature, as it were, and see where the fuck I was with playing, you know, one of the most iconic parts in the canon and my one chance to play that on film, I imagine. And it's hugely important to me, this work, and it's about making Shakespeare accessible to people through their televisions, as well as making it the best form of accessible Shakespeare, and, you know, all the challenges of that role. So, you know, I'm in the middle of a major, major job, and I'm getting on a plane to come and gas and have fun, and not gas, sorry, you know, not fart, although, you know, God knows that might be involved at some point, but with Ben Stiller, but well, not Ben Stiller. No, who did you say?
I said Adam Sandler.
You said Adam Sandler.
But
sorry,
Ben Stiller.
They're not interchangeable. They're very different.
They're very different.
An error
but Ben's
on my
not
part.
Above a fart joke.
I mean, I'm no comment. I mean, I don't know where they both stand on the tasteometer of fart jokes, but I that is a real concern. That is a real concern. Not just energy and focus, but also. Part of it, part of the difficulty, I guess, of fame is to not become too self-conscious of it. It's hard to do if you walk into a room and people sort of turn their heads and they know you and you don't know them. It's hard to do when you arrive somewhere to thousands of people screaming. It's hard to do when you're talking nonstop about a performance or a moment in your career or your private life or trying not to talk about your private life. It's hard to do to not be self-conscious of all of that because you're constantly in a kind of loop or bubble of it.
Sure.
But yeah, there are methods and means to kind of extricate yourself from that headset and try and get back to focusing on work. And thank God I went to drama school for some of those. Thank God I've worked with people who've inspired me, who I can always go, what would they do now? And just my own resources that I have from, I don't know, the journey I've been on in life, really. So, yeah.
But did I read that you also... there's meditation, like you meditate and there's mindfulness?
All too infrequently, but yeah, that's a very, very helpful thing to bring you back to some kind of understanding of where you're at. You hear the traffic in your head. You don't hold on to it. You don't try and control it. As anyone who's ever practiced mindfulness knows, you let it go. You just let it pass through. And it's amazing quite how much stuff you carry around with you when you're doing things like this. You don't realize that you have to shed to get deeper, but I mean, you know, I've got a lot further to go on that journey. I really do, and I want to, you know, it's that's a part of my life that literally getting on and off planes kind of kills a little bit. So yeah. It's important. It's really important to carve that time out, and for music and other hobbies, you know, painting and the hobby of life of being with friends and family. You know.
That is a whole separate skill set sometimes.
Yeah, no, I talk about it. Well, I mean, you know, it is. People sort of look at me and go, how the fuck do you do it? And sometimes I don't think I do. I look at my work and I go, well, that could have been better if I hadn't been doing everything else that I was doing. I also, you know, I think I could be a better person sometimes because of being as busy as I am, it's a struggle. And confessional corner, suddenly it's taken, no wonder I'm not doing any comedies. I'm just kind of spilling my soul to you guys. But basically what I'm trying to say is, it's been lovely to meet you. Thanks. Goodbye.
No, wait, do you know the responsibility of that we would have if you just impression. Jumped out the window?
It's not going to happen here, folks. Don't worry.
So, I guess
we got some dead air.
Really falling. No, it's the gravity.
Gravity. Film.
The Imitation Game comes out in theaters November 20.
We might be postponed a bit.
Cumbersplat. No, fuck. Oh, God damn it.
Cumbersplat. Oh man, that's a goodie. Listeners throw all thoughts of me being suicidal.
No, it's not happening. But you do skydive, right?
I do skydive. I do like throwing myself out.
So there's a little bit of you that's suicidal.
Yeah, but I don't think this is the end. I can't deal with it anymore.
Try to be fair, before
hopefully I'm going to be landing with a parachute, and you know it's all going to be nice.
His last words were, "Fuck, where's my parachute?" the skydiving thing is something that I've always.
That does make you very present. My goodness,
you would have to be because you want to make you need to live.
I've done about 3, I think now, and 1 static line jump, which is even scarier. Because you jump out. You're drilled what to do, how to cut away, how to open your own chute, but you jump out and the line opens it as you come out. So rather like the instructor, but not just the control chute, the whole thing. So you clear the plane and then poof, you're already floating. But you have 30 seconds or something like that. If that fails, or if your lines are tangled, which you have to check incredibly quickly, because if you can't steer the thing, you're in trouble. You have to learn how to cut away and open your reserve. I mean, it's
wow.
Yeah.
In a moment where you're experiencing something that human beings would not necessarily evolve to experience, which is terminal velocity.
Terminal velocity, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the video, the footage of the guys that basically just balloon up to the outer, to the edge of the atmosphere and then just leap is...
Well, that one guy. I mean, and what a phenomenal achievement that was. I mean, you know, he nearly blacked out. He went into a spin and managed to recover. As did the pilot of the recent Virgin Galactic tragedy. You know, I was reading about it the other day, and he passed out and then came to in time to get out of his seatbelt and get out of his seat and open his chute. An extraordinary time we're living in. Extraordinary time.
But it makes you feel. Does it make you feel alive?
When you're doing that, under sort of more controlled conditions, proper sky jump. Yeah, it does. It does. It really does. And I think it came at a time when I'd experienced someone sort of forcibly holding a gun to my head, and I was kind of angry at not having the control of that, and became a bit of adrenaline junkie. I think just to look over the edge under my own steam. This is when I was carjacked in South Africa, which was quite an ordeal that went on for 2 and a bit hours and 2 other actors with me. And, you know, we were very lucky.
There was, I read about that. It was 2005, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I think because of that, there's 2 ways you can go. You go insular, protective and neurotic about the threat or the fear of what might be the threat outside. Or you go, come on then, and just walk straight back into the flame. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I've got to do that. I've got to do that because... it's one of the reasons I want to do this job as well, you know. And I was still, we had a lot more to shoot, a third of the series still to shoot. and that fed in massively to both the performance, but also really just my life afterwards. And I stayed behind in South Africa on my own and went traveling on my own, went to Namibia and did crazy things out of aeroplanes. Great fun.
But walking back into the flame that's a good analogy for that. And also sort of seeking safety in the heart of danger and not, you know, because it's like, well, I can either live and be miserable and afraid of everything or just let it go.
Sort of embrace your fears. Just embrace it all. I mean, I think, to be honest, that's what I've been doing with work, with everything really. It's just trying to, you know, accept challenges when they're offered me. And maybe now the challenge is to know when to say no to challenges that are offered me. That's another challenge.
That'll be the one that you never, that when you first start out, you're never really
we're
prepared.
We're programmed to be, I worked in kitchens, I worked as a waiter, I worked in shops. I did, you know, did all the sort of jobs just to pay the rent and tide you over and try and pay back the debt to your parents, in my case, who afforded me my ridiculously expensive education. And it's just like you're living hand to mouth. you get a job. First of all, you cannot believe you're being paid to act. That's that, and that still thrills me. I feel now more it's about being paid to do the stuff around the acting, to be honest. But because I still get such a kick out of my work, I really do. I really, really do. And but in the beginning, you were trained to accept everything with ultimate gratitude because you might never work again. And then slowly you start thinking, oh, okay, well, no, this, I've got a little bit of, you know, longevity. Hopefully, it's not flash in the pan stuff. So I could sort of take the foot off the accelerator and have a look at life.
But it's part of the strategy that, you know, like in the beginning, it's just like survive. Strategy. Gee, yeah. Be smart about
which is great.
This.
It's a great game change.
I still have the first $20 I was handed for doing comedy.
Did you really? Keep it?
Yeah.
So cool. Yeah.
What is it? What was it for?
It was for,
you were paid in cash. I was paid in ice cream. I didn't get to keep
really?
My ice cream. No, I was paid in cash.
I framed this ice cream.
But you literally got like
a
$20 bill.
Yeah, it was a cut. It was a cut from a door of a
club.
Jimmy Dore show.
Oh, buddy.
Oh, that's
adorable.
So cool.
Look at that.
I kept it, and it's in my humidor with some Cuban cigars.
with the Cristal champagne. the other trophies of my success.
I was paid in diamonds. as we're sort of like ramping down, we saw him at Tasting Into the Night, and it's fucking fantastic. And as I'm watching, I'm kind of wondering, how much more pressure is it? Because obviously, touring stories. Mm. First of all, it's tragic and brilliant and
funny.
It's and funny and wonderful and you know, there's this sort of parallel between him and this machine that's out of place and sort of he's almost an anachronism. He's an anachronism.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And so. And this story wasn't really public for a long time, and so there's it feels like a tremendous amount of responsibility when you, because you know, you know, Sherlock's a guy, but he's not a real guy, and you know,
he comes with a pretty,
he comes with a whole separate
of the iconic
baggage
characters. Like, you better get this one right, but you're
touring
right,
stories, so. Like he's so, because what happened to him is just the worst thing that can happen to anyone, particularly after they've saved millions
of people.
The
very democracy and government that he saved that turned on him, and in a time of intolerance. Prosecuted him for being
the father of computation and algorithms, and you know, and he was into morphogenesis and all these other really interesting.
Yeah.
And he, you know, and so do you feel responsibility? Is there more responsibility when you're playing this guy and telling his story?
A little, yeah, I think so. It's hard to quantify more or less, especially you know, in regards to other characters I played, that where there is a lot of footage or audio recording or you know, evidence of them, or they have a public persona already. This man in sort of comparison to his achievements is relatively unknown, and that's part of the sort of ironic disgrace of what we of how we repaid him. And you know, hopefully, if this film does anything, if it is a hit, if people go and see it, is it will put him in the public conscience. And the amount of people that have said, I can't believe I don't know this story. I can't believe I don't know more about this man. I knew a little bit about him, but some people knowing nothing about him. So if this brings him to a wider audience, to a broader audience, and gives him a larger stage and platform to be recognized on, then I will feel incredibly happy, because he is without doubt one of the most extraordinary unsung relative to his achievements heroes of all time. I mean, he took the work that Ada Lovelace and Charles Babbage did very early on in the 1800s with the idea
engines.
Of a differential machine, yes, and algorithms, and crystallized that into a mechanical method for performing mathematical functions, which basically was the blueprint and still is now for the universal machine, the Turing machine, what we call the computer.
Right.
So the premise is that the infrastructure of a computer works the same wherever you are in the world. Now, if that hadn't been put in place, the internet would not work.
No.
Nothing would work. No coding would work. Nothing to do with the networking that we have, this entire digital village of a world that we have now would work. I mean, the sort of knock-on effects of his brilliance and his achievement and his standing in that field alone is beyond compare, really. And on top of that, he was part of a top code-breaking team of cryptographers at Bletchley Park, a man who used algorithms, which, by the way, are still used now in Google search engines. That's a great irony. You look on Google for Alan Turing and it comes up with me, which I had to apologize to his family at the London premiere for, because it's slightly misleading, you know, this brilliant man, and now he's just being twinned with an actor who's lucky enough to portray him in a film. But going back to the coding, you know, he cracked the, with others and with the, an adaptation of the Polish code breaking machine, which has to be stated because the Poles had made a great advance, but it wouldn't have got anywhere with the Enigma machine as it had then been adapted. So Turing's work on that was fundamental to breaking the code, giving us a completely transparent map of everything that the Nazis were trying to hide in all their maneuvers across the world in the Second World War. And thereby, with a very select use of that information, we were able to stop the Second World War, some estimate 2 years earlier than it could have dragged on for, therefore saving an estimated 14 million lives. He's a war hero. Now that, because of 35 years of the Secrecy Act, you know, is partly why he's not as famous there. Partly then, I think, because of what happened in the 50s as well, where he was after his house was burgled, a police investigation revealed that he'd solicited a man in a pub, and he confessed in an interview to being a homosexual man, an active homosexual man, in a time of McCarthyist intolerance of what was seen and diagnosed as being morally corrupt and degenerate. Behavior, words that are strong enough to make you blanch in modern times, but added to which came a prosecution and a public trial and the sentence of either 2 years imprisonment or 2 years state-sanctioned chemical castration through weekly estrogen injections. I mean, it is barbaric. This is less than 100 years ago, and that was the reward, a man who was both the hero of the computer age, of the scientific world, and of the Second World War was the recipient of. And he was given a choice. He chose the estrogen injections to carry on work, you know, to carry on being able to build and manufacture both programming and the physical entity of computing that he was involved with in Manchester. The ravaging effects of the estrogen didn't just stop after 2 years. He said early on, he was said to have had early on in the treatment a conversation with the doctor who, and this I heard from someone I spoke to, one of the only about three people I spoke to who'd met him and could give me some kind of personal insight to the man and how he was and how he behaved and how this appalling incident at the end of his life affected him. And it was a friend of his who was a lab technician that spoke very highly of him, both as a professional and as a person. And he said that an indication of this extraordinary man's ability was and talent and sorry humanity really was that when he was asked, he went, "Oh yeah, no, it's I'm dealing with it. I mean, you know, I had these injections, and the doctor said it was rather embarrassing for both of us, isn't it? Why don't I give you this slow release device? I'll put it in your hip, and it'll release based on your metabolism, and it'll stop dosing you after 2 years. And it's a lot after 2 years now, and it's still dosing me. And that's not really cricket, is it?" And from that sort of humorous dismissal, that sort of stiff upper lip reserve, he then had a dark night of the soul where this Olympian athlete, this marathon runner of Olympian standards, this active gay man, very much a man who is involved with his body, let's say, not just a scientist in an ivory tower or, you know, a brain in a glass jar. He went into his kitchen, opened a drawer and took out a carving knife and gouged his leg open to try and remove the device. This was the same man who was being ravaged both physically and mentally by this drug that wouldn't stop releasing and who in the end, at the age of 41, saw no way out but to take his own life with swallowing cyanide. And he then bit an apple and laid it on the table, even as I think, without doubt, a final act of kindness to his mother. So that it looked like an accident. You know, he had cyanide in the house. He was always experimenting with trying to make weed killer and all sorts of other sort of household chemical inventions. And he, I think he staged it for that reason. And Steve Jobs has said, I wish it was the inspiration for the Apple logo, but it wasn't. You know, the man's favorite film was Snow White, Poisonous Apple, the same with the Apple of Knowledge.
But he does say, there's a line in the movie where he says, think differently. And I immediately thought it was the old Apple...
Oh, yeah. No. Well, I don't think that's intentional. I don't think that's intentional at all. because, you know, I mean, I've spoken to Stephen Fry and other people who interviewed Steve Jobs. And he categorically denied it, but with the greatest of respect for a man that he wished he had used the logo, in deference of, in memory of. So, you know, I care about this person. I really, really care about him. And we shot those scenes very near the end of the schedule of the filming. So, I was incredibly involved to the extent that I couldn't actually stop or control the emotion that was needed for the scene. I just had to remove myself from the room after three early takes of it. which is not going, oh, look at me, am I acting? It was bad acting, if anything. I was grieving the subject. I was grieving Alan, you know. I became really angry and frustrated and incredibly, incredibly moved by this man's plight. So yeah, it means a great deal to me. Great deal to me. So if we've done him any justice, or if I've done him any justice in my portrayal, then that's all I need to know. And his family believe that we have, and that I have, and that's the best and only review.
It's nice to win an award, but that's the best thing.
Yeah, it really.
That's
is.
The best thing.
It really is.
Because
really
if you're holding the award, and they were like, "Hey, we didn't like what you." Oh no! But I.
Yeah, horrible sense of conflicting guilt and joy. Oh, I don't. Yeah, can I keep the award anyway?
This is really good. It's really shiny. It's really shiny.
Do you want a bit? Do you want half it? Maybe I can get you a chocolate one. I'll get you one maybe chocolate. We can eat it.
Should give out chocolate. The Oscars should be made of chocolate. We have the you have to
Wolfgang just Puck makes the Oscars this year. That's what's to happen.
Of course, all the edible menu is Wolfgang Puck.
Genius.
And every gift basket has
that
a
that way we can
Oscar
all share the goodies.
Those are rich people wings, the wings of the Oscar.
Yeah,
just,
yeah.
Like, dip the wing sauce. I don't want to make you late for your next thing.
Thank you.
It is we are almost exactly to now.
Because you know how anxious I am about those damn spiders.
I am. There's a there's a million of them
until
in the hall.
Walk you through a nest of them now.
They're going to get in your way.
All waiting for me. Bigfoot's already in there doing the interview.
When I first worked with Benedict, I realized he was a selfish motherfucker.
Very. His feet aren't that big at all, actually. My feet.
He doesn't have as much hair as I do.
Yeah. But we were delightful on this podcast, and it was really lovely to speak to you.
Likewise.
Now, great we film. Normally we end the podcast by saying enjoy.
With a visual gesture.
There's that, a no, visual
that someone
gesture
has to then guess.
And a short interpretive dance.
Fist
okay, here's my visual
point.
Gesture. They have to guess what it is.
Okay.
I don't even know what that's a reference to, but
thank you. I don't know. It could be a window into your personal
your oh, background yes. extra in William H. Macy's The Cooler.
Great
very
call.
Good. Very,
Matt didn't even
good.
Bug you about Star Trek, which is amazing.
Well, listen, I kept it to what we're currently promoting.
We gotta,
yeah,
we gotta
exactly
let him go.
Quite right.
Would you please tell we end by saying yeah, enjoy your burrito. Will you please tell people to enjoy their burrito? And then you know, if you wanted to make a fart sound after that, you're more than welcome to. I think it would be a nice way to land.
Please enjoy your burrito. Yeah, yeah. Or I could do a variation. Should we do a variation? Well, because I love the atomic fart.
Sure,
I think it's one
sure.
of the greatest inventions of the modern age. It's obviously what Alan Turing's work was heading towards. But one of my favorites is the princess, which is just... And then there's the open door classic.
How about the... do you know, are you familiar with the Who Me?
And then there's the what just happened. And then juice anyone.
Juice anyone.
That's just not right. That's just not right.
And then.
Spat all the side of my face.
Yeah.
Just the. Oh my goodness. Okay. Wonderful.
Now leaving nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.